Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Of travel I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston,
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Well, thank you very much, Audrey, and marvelous job tonight. We lost the switchboard twice, and you got us back on, and got us back on in time, which is absolutely fabulous, and we appreciate that, Audrey. Tonight we're going to be having a quote or some commentary from one of your countrymen, your former countrymen over there in England, and I think you'll enjoy listening to what he has to say about surveillance and some of the cautions that he raises as he leaves his position of chief prosecutor in that nation. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Blog Talk Radio Network and the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm your host, Keith Haley. Once again, we want to thank Johnny Cash for that fine trip. He takes us across the United States, where he travels to 90 different cities and states in the U.S. And yes, he does sing that song from memory, or did. He's probably singing it right now, and he's probably rejoicing over the fact that when he gets in that truck with that truck driver, he won't be here and complain too much about gas and oil prices, because they're pretty low. I was talking to some folks who were in Dallas this week. Gas was down, and they saw gas down there at $2.21 a gallon. So that's pretty good. That goes back a ways. What do you think, Mike? I think so. Mike and Emily, good to see both of you tonight, and thank you for gathering up some news stories for us. Ladies and gentlemen, what we try to do on the show is discuss issues and events, current news and developments in this field of criminal justice and criminal justice practice. Sometimes it's serious, sometimes it's humorous, and sometimes it's in between. We dedicate the show to those energetic and ever-ending working police, court, corrections, and juvenile justice professionals who protect us throughout the United States and throughout the world, indeed. What we try to do is look inside the criminal justice practice, and most of the time I think folks have told us that we do a fairly good job of doing that. Tonight, there's no guest per se. We're going to be playing a fairly long audio clip that I think is one of the best discussions I've heard post 9/11 about where we're going and where we shouldn't go or where we could go in this business of video and audio surveillance. So I think you're going to enjoy this clip. You're on the Blog Talk Radio Network. I always like to get new customers if we can. You go to the main page, blogtalkradio.com, I think you can be signed up in about 10 minutes and have your, less than that probably, and have your own show space set up, and you can broadcast live, streaming audio to an unlimited number of listeners worldwide, and it costs absolutely nothing. And who knows how many hours a week you can broadcast now. We do one. There are people that broadcast an hour, more than an hour each day of the week. So you're able to do that too. Get your own show is what I always say, and more and more people are doing that. Blog Talk Radio Network, you know, has joined that list of the 100 top websites in the world. And that's remarkable when you think it's been just about 2 years when Alan Levy, the CEO of BTR, started this whole thing with one little discussion with members of his family and close friends concerning the passing, I believe, of his father. So tonight we're going to be taking a look at this whole issue of giving you a little watching you update on the surveillance camera gaffe, we're calling it. And as you read the news like I do, it's just amazing to me that you read folks talking in London and Paris and Chicago, New York and Raleigh and all over the place. They're all worried that they don't have enough surveillance cameras. And when is enough enough? And we'll have to try to figure that out. You could do a little calling in tonight. We're going to move through some news stories that are pretty quick tonight in order that we can play this clip that exceeds more than like 40 minutes. So I think, again, that you're really going to enjoy that. And those of you who are criminal justice instructors or law enforcement, political science for that matter, you may be interested in replaying this particular segment of the show. And, of course, it's archived on the net, as are all of the shows, and I think we're well up over 100 now at this point. And you can download those at your own will. Keep them, store them, and use them however you would like. If you want to call into the show, the call-in number tonight is 347-996-5983. That's 347-996-5983. And we'll be glad to discuss any of these things with you. Audrey, I know you have a blonde joke tonight. Should we have a first-time listener, I point out that Audrey England, who is our technical and spiritual advisor for the show, you've already heard from her. She's been a collector of blonde jokes for a long time, and this one is really good. Talk about a play on words. Audrey, why don't you go ahead with this one? Got it? Okay.
Professor Haley, tonight's blonde joke is about an enterprising young blonde. Hope you like it. A blonde, wanting to earn some money, decided to hire herself out as a handyman type and started canvassing a wealthy neighborhood. She went to the front door of the first house and asked the owner if he had any jobs for her to do. Well, you can paint my porch. How much will you charge? The blonde said, how about $50? The man agreed and told her that the paint and ladders she would need were in the garage. The man's wife, inside the house, heard the conversation and said to her husband, does she realize that the porch goes all the way around the house? The man replied, she should. She was standing on the porch. A short time later, the blonde came to the door to collect her money. You're finished already? He asked. Yes, the blonde answered, and I had paint left over, so I gave it 2 coats. Impressed, the man reached in his pocket for the $50. And by the way, the blonde added, that's not a porch, it's a Ferrari.
All right, she painted his car. All right. All right, that's a good one, Audrey. I appreciate that. Ladies and gentlemen, on a much more serious note, as we approach the autumn and the winter time and moving up to Christmas time when robberies seem to increase every December of our lives during the holiday season, the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence, Against Firearms, has a public service announcement that they would like all of us to hear, particularly the gangbangers and street criminals, in order that they would go turn in their firearms.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Well, thank you very much, Ohio Coalition, and it certainly is a deadly idea. Ladies and gentlemen, let's start off with a little bit of the bizarre tonight in terms of a news story. This is an interesting one where a guy goes in to do a robbery, and his weapon of use there is a silver machete. Well, during this struggle and this armed robbery in this particular establishment, I think it was a brothel, if I'm not mistaken. Yes, it was. They take his machete from him, and they cut off his thumb. And ouch. But he takes off with the money. And later on, he shows up at the hospital and trying to get that finger fixed. And they found out about it. And after 2 hours after the robbery, a nine-fingered Perez went to an emergency room. Police found out about it, fingerprinted the thumb, and transported it to the hospital for a comparison, according to a report. According to an arrest affidavit, a doctor told police that the thumb fits like a puzzle. He was transported to the hospital, and then I think he's going to be going on to the jail also, would you imagine? But, boy, that's terrible when they take something away from you like that. That is really bad. Here's another one I think you'll be interested in. San Francisco is considering to be the first U.S. city to decriminalize prostitution. Boy, they go on and on in this article about what advantages this would be. It would allow the prostitutes to organize. They wouldn't have to walk the streets anymore. They could probably get higher wages. Proponents say that the measure will free up $11 million that the police now spend each year in arresting prostitutes and allow them now to form collectives. In fact, they've even had prostitutes come in from other states. They talk about a woman here from Texas, Patricia West. She's come up to Texas to kind of help them with the levy, Proposition K. Not everybody's for it. A lot of the people in the police district and the political folks there, they're saying that this proposition would bring other things with it, robberies, for example, narcotics, etc. So a lot of the people in the police department are maybe perhaps all of them, are against this. And it'll be interesting to see if they become the first city to actually do that. I'm a little suspect of the fact that this will pass, but we'll see. We do have a couple places that legalize prostitution. You know, one is in Nevada. And I didn't know that the state of Rhode Island, prostitution is legal. How about that? Perfectly legal as long as it's done inside among consenting adults. You can't have any type of street prostitution. So that's interesting. I didn't know that about Rhode Island. People know more about that. Rhode Island's business would probably pick up. How do you like the idea of a pickpocket that's been arrested 73 times and she's 76 years old? They caught her one more time and... this is in Washington, D.C., I believe, yes, on a 1600, she lists her address as 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. I'm sorry, this is New York. She gets picked up one more time. They caught her in a supermarket, and they saw her putting her hands in the wallets and pockets and purses of a lot of different people. But can you imagine that? 73 arrests at that particular age. It's absolutely incredible, but pickpockets are usually ones that make a pretty good living, and they think it's worth getting caught every once in a while. I thought you'd be interested in this. This is the chief prosecution officer in Great Britain who's leaving his post after a period of time, and his name is Sir Ken MacDonald, and he's attacking the Big Brother surveillance state. I know what some people would probably say. Doesn't it sound like they're about 10 years late on this? But not true. He says he's given a warning of the dangers of plans for a massive expansion of Big Brother state surveillance and a growth of the security state. And I would say, based on my research over this the last 5 or 6 years, that no state compares to Great Britain. Everybody runs second. He says that the enormous powers of access to information that technology had given the state should be used with great care. We need to take great care not to fall into a way of life in which freedom's back is broken by the relentless pressure of a security state. Isn't that a great line? We shouldn't break the back of freedom by this relentless pressure of a security state. And if I hear one more person say that it shouldn't make any difference that the government, federal, state, whatever local level you're talking about, if they spy on you, it should make any difference because if you're not doing anything wrong. Boy, I'm telling you, folks that lived in dictatorships usually lost their liberties one at a time. He says this information society technology gave the state enormous powers to access knowledge and information about each one of us and the ability to collect and store it at will every second of every day in everything we do. And I think he's right. He was given an address here. He called for level-headedness and some legislative restraint in expanding these powers. He says, we need to understand it is the nature of state power that decisions taken in the next few months and years about how the state may use these powers and to what extent they're likely to be irreversible. This will be with us forever. Aren't these great lines? I mean, I agree with him. He says they in turn will be built upon. In other words, what they build today in terms of taking powers away will only be the beginning. And everything else after that will seem to be okay. So we should take great care to imagine the world we are creating before we build it. We might end up living with something that we can't bear. And he's stepping down from his position. And he says, right now the government is examining ways to collect and store records of phone calls, emails, and internet traffic without the right to monitor the flow of internet messaging. The police and security services said they would have to consider a massive expansion of surveillance. So actually the internal snooping with the records and email and phone calls and internet traffic would allow them to not expand the, the overt surveillance on streets and in other places. But isn't this incredible? He described his period as the chief prosecutor as a relentless prosecutorial struggle against terrorism to which he was committed. He said, but that doesn't mean that everything is okay. He regards people's rights as absolutely priceless. I love that language. He says, we need to stop this terrorism, but we need to do something about it in a reasonable way and not go overboard, because, again, that's going to be the foundation that they're going to be living with in the future. We make it less likely that the state will bring cases which shouldn't be brought and which are not justified by the evidence. Good man. I think I enjoy what he's talking about. Here's last one. It's on a lighter side in some ways, but I was talking to some folks in a class this week about, this is in Blue Ash, Ohio. Now, I don't know all the details. Journalists don't get all the details, but they say there that an 89-year-old woman is facing a charge of petty theft because neighborhood children accuse her of refusing to give back their football. And Edna Jester, she was arrested last week in Cincinnati, the suburb of Blue Ash. Police said the one child's father complained that Jester kept the youngster's football after it landed in her yard. Police Captain James Schaefer says there has been an ongoing dispute in the neighborhood over kids' balls landing in the woman's yard. But they got so many calls about it, they didn't have time to discuss it anymore. And they went and, I did the arrest, and she's scheduled to show up in court next month. And she can be fined 6 months in jail and a dollar fine of up to $1,000. I don't know. It's been a long time since I worked on a police cruiser, but would that be the answer, really, folks? Couldn't you think, if that's the facts, couldn't you think of three or four other things that you might do besides arresting an 89-year-old woman for this petty theft, even if she did it, which there's a good chance she probably did. But, I think I'd figure out what that football price was as a beat cop and go down to Walmart or go down to a good sporting store and buy the kid a football and be done. Be done with the whole thing, but I don't know about booking 89-year-old women. But what we're going to look at now, folks, is a really interesting discussion about something that's been going on a long time, and this discussion fits right in behind the occurrence of September 11th, of course, 2001. And what you're going to see in this discussion is a three people, I think a fourth one joins them, and they're going to be talking about how far should we go in the expansion of surveillance and snooping and warrantless searches and this type of business. And it's going to take me a minute here to make the switch. I have to do a little technological wizardry here for just a moment, but I think you'll enjoy this this entire discussion. Here we go.
Still working. Don't leave. Don't leave. I think we have it. So I apologize. We made it.
This is Dr. Panisi, Ira Flato. It sounds like something out of an Orwellian novel. As you walk down Main Street, check your baggage at the airport, serve over to a webpage on the internet, or sit up just in front of your TV set on the couch, a camera compares your face to a mugshot of wanted criminals and terrorists. Now, with each click of the send button, your email is scrutinized for devious content. And nestled deep in your wallet is a small identity card that stores all kinds of data, your health status, your location, and whether you're a security risk. Although fictionalized in the book 1984 by George Orwell, These technologies aren't fast becoming feasible, but will and should they be implemented? September 11th changed not only how Americans look at the world, also how the digital world looks at them. Government officials are calling for new powers of electronic surveillance. How well can these technologies prevent another terrorist attack? Will the price we pay be a loss of personal privacy and freedom? And are we willing to pay it? That's what we'll be talking about this hour, and we'll also be talking about new technologies and techniques being used and ones in the works, new ones that are being developed for electronic surveillance. And if you want to talk about that, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. 1-800-989-TALK. As always, if you want more information about what we're talking about this hour, go to our website at sciencefriday.com, where you'll find links to our topic. Now, let me introduce my guest. Ari Schwartz is Associate Director of the Center for Democracy and Technology in Washington. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Frank Gaffney is President of the Center for Security Policy and former Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration, and he also joins us from Washington. Please welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. Thank you.
How close are we to some of these new technologies? I already mentioned that some of these are already being developed. We keep hearing of new things all the time. Are we now going to be seeing a burst of activity in developing new kinds of surveillance technologies, do you think? Let me ask first Ari Schwartz.
Well, we already have seen quite a burst in activity. This was going on well before the September 11th attacks, and we saw in the Tampa Bay area they have facial recognition scanning, comparing people's faces they walk down a public street to a database. A company called Visionix is trying to sell that to every law enforcement agency in the country, and there are many other similar technologies in the public spaces as well as in our homes.
Mm-hmm. What do you say, Frank Gaffney?
I think the march of technology is a pretty well established phenomenon, and whether the technologies you've described are at hand or already available or will be coming on stream in due course is, I think, frankly, a little less important than do we need such technologies to be brought on stream as part of equipping law enforcement in this country to deal with a threat which, at least if I read the front page of the Washington Post correctly today, and I think other papers around the country reflect this, it is a near, if not an imminent, danger of much more serious terrorism than even we've seen in recent weeks.
Yeah, there was a warning this morning of something about 100% certainty of another attack occurring if we go into Afghanistan.
Yeah,
I think that's what you're referring to, right?
Yeah, you don't know whether. Well, that's part of it. You don't know whether to credit that as part of the disinformation that people who don't want us to engage in this war on terrorism are putting out, or whether it's no kidding, a 100% probability. But setting that aside, I think what you're hearing from officials both in the executive and the legislative branch now is that there is a very high probability of future, further, and probably worse terror. And the question is, should law enforcement be equipped to do what they can?
In fact, I actually disagree with that statement. I think that there is not a question that law enforcement should be able to use surveillance capabilities. I think that they have many of these technological capabilities that we've already discussed at their disposal. The question is, when should they be allowed to use it, and under what kind of oversight?
No, I don't mean to suggest you agreed with it. I just said I think that's the more interesting question than exactly where in the technology curve are these various items.
All right, we're going to get into that. Let me bring another guest in to talk about that. Tom Colatassi is president and CEO of Visage Technologies in Littleton, Massachusetts. Welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
I noticed you make the facial recognition software, don't you?
That is correct.
And I noticed your stock has just, I don't know what the stock is today, but it's up like 800% since the World Trade Center disaster. Is that right? Something like that?
It certainly has been up. I don't know what it is today. Those stock markets can be fickle, and no one can account for emotion of buying and selling stock in a given day. We try to focus on technology and customers, and the stock will reach its own level.
Now, you use this, or I shouldn't say you use it, but the technology was used during the Super Bowl to screen for possible terrorists or criminals in the Super Bowl. And people were aghast when they heard about that. Do you think people are as aghast now or would be as aghast if they knew that this was happening at big events like that?
That was our technology and our company that did do it in the Super Bowl. And unfortunately, you know, we've got all of this rhetoric about privacy and it drowned it out, a rational, intelligent conversation around security versus privacy. And what didn't get covered before September 11th and is now getting covered is that if you were going into the Super Bowl or an airport and you crossed one of our cameras and we weren't retaining your image and we didn't know your name, didn't know where you live, didn't know where you work, didn't know where you're coming from, didn't know where you were going, the only thing we know is that you're not on the database, how is that possibly an invasion of race privacy?
Well, let me get a reaction from our reports on it.
Well, there's this question of what are the rules of how this information is going to be used in the future? How is it stored? How are perhaps I don't know the details of Visage. I haven't really followed it that closely. But how are these companies, these private companies that are working with the government, going to use this information in the future? We don't have rules set for that. This is being made up on the fly.
No, to the contrary, Ari. The rules are quite clear. We don't own any content, so we provide the technology, but when we did the Super Bowl, it was those images that were provided to us by law enforcement officials. When we do a casino, it's the images that the casino operators own.
But that's not the rules. That's not the law. That is your decision to do that as a company. And so there's the question of what are the standards out there, and we actually had quite a bit of feedback that we don't want to have these standards set. I think that some of the biometric companies, I know that you were included in this, have come out and said that you'd like to see standards set, and we completely agree with that. Law enforcement, on the other hand, has come out and said that they don't want to see standards set because they'd like to be able to make decisions in the future about how to use this and not be tied to one standard or another, and that concerns civil libertarians going down the road.
Well, it concerns me at two levels. One is, certainly we have some control over what's in our credit report, and if someone said something bad about us, we have some address. And we believe quite strongly that if your face is in the database, you ought to know that it's in there, and you ought to know if it was in there in error and how to get it out, and there ought to be all sorts of legislation controlling that. Secondly, we've been quite adamant that we believe it is appropriate that high-risk targets such as the Super Bowl or airports and things of that nature, that this technology is appropriate, but we refuse to do it in city streets like at Ybor City in Tampa and Virginia Beach. And we agree, I think, on this point that control over the database, and it should only be installed in places that really are risks and not areas that are spying on individuals determining what bar they went to and how often they went to that bar and who they went with. But let me just interject here. It does seem to me that there's another basis upon which to make this choice of using this particular technology, for example, and that is not necessarily places that are high risk, but places that people voluntarily put themselves into, as opposed to, you know, walking down the street. If they're going into an airport, they're going into a football stadium, they're going into some other movie theater, someplace where currently surveillance cameras might well be placed for security reasons. Then using this technology, I think, could be part of the contract, in effect, of people taking advantage of those facilities and the services that they offer. That's a different thing, it seems to me, than just randomly monitoring streets, and I think there are some concerns about civil liberties in that regard, but you also probably would see some diminution in interest of those areas from a targeting point of view to an adversary who wants to inflict mass destruction upon us. Yeah, you know, we think that having it, because it was deployed in what I would call trivial, outrageous applications like city streets that really offered no security threat at all or just frivolous, that caused the debate to become so extreme that it deflected us from having an intelligent conversation about areas that I think most of us would agree that it should be deployed in.
I strongly agree with that idea. The problem is, as I was saying before, that we don't have these kind of standards and rules set into law so that it can be used in extreme situations. And that's really the problem that we see today.
Right, but isn't there legislation in Congress that is going to set some standards or create rules for this use, or is it just going to make it much broader?
There are some standards out there that are being set that are actually going to pull down the current standards and the current oversight to lower levels, and in some cases completely get rid of some of the current oversight that we have. And that's really what we're concerned about, is that we're creating, instead of creating the real standards and setting real standards, we are diminishing the current standards and not seeing new ones set in areas, but for example, for internet monitoring, for monitoring of the kind that we're talking about on city streets and that kind, what we're doing is instead pulling down removing the kind of standards that we have for current wiretapping authority on the phone and in the phone network and extending that to the internet generally.
Kyra, I want to come back to what I think really is the baseline question here, and that is, under what circumstances are we thinking about a compromise of civil liberties that I don't think any of us relish? I certainly don't. I'm not anxious to see our free society any more constrained or adulterated than is absolutely necessary. But I think if, as these warnings suggest, we're in for a much worse patch ahead. I hope they're wrong, but if that's true, it does seem to me that it behooves us to make maximum use of technology that we can under well-crafted, ideally, and carefully deliberated, ideally, arrangements, to be sure, but to make maximum use of this technology to prevent such episodes. Because I can tell you, if we have a weapon of mass destruction used against a major population center in this country, civil liberties are going to go by the board en masse.
We all agree with that. The question is, what is the oversight going to be? And right now, we're having to pull down that oversight.
Under those circumstances.
We want to do more.
Wait, let me get one of the
oversight.
One at a time, gentlemen.
Sure.
Under those circumstances, there will be precious little oversight. I think if we can craft these arrangements quickly so that they can be brought to bear and hopefully prevent these attacks, then it behooves all of us to do that. And I don't think that's where we're headed right now.
But you said, maybe contradictory, maybe not, but you said quickly but with tremendous deliberation.
I said ideally with due deliberation. I'm just saying as between bringing them to bear quickly and duly deliberating under the circumstances, I honestly come down on the side of putting them into place quickly with certain constraints like, you know, these will be reviewed after 6 months or whatever the timeline might be, a year. But get them in place and allow law enforcement to be using them to prevent kinds of terror that we believe could be imminent.
Yeah, but exactly what you're talking about is what's not being shown in this bill. We're extending the time periods for the kind of oversight that's held. We're extending secret searches, at least in the new Senate compromise that's out there, so that individuals never find out whether they were ever surveilled, even when the investigation has ended. We're talking about much less oversight than what we've had in the past.
Gentlemen, we're gonna take a break. We have to go. We're going to have to take a quick break, and we'll come back and talk lots more about this with Ari Schwartz, Frank Gaffney, and Tom Colatassi. So stay with us. We'll take your calls when we come back and talk lots more about security and privacy. Stay with us. I'm Ira Flato, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Welcome back to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. We're talking this hour about security and privacy and new surveillance techniques that may impinge on our civil liberties. Some people think we need to do that. Well, we're going to take some of your phone calls and find out. What's my guess? Ari Schwartz, who is Associate Director of Center for Democracy and Technology in Washington. Frank Gaffney, President of the Center for Security Policy and former Assistant Secretary of Defense under Ronald Reagan. And Tom Colatassi, who's president and CEO of Visage Technologies in Littleton, Massachusetts, and they make that facial recognition software. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Let's get a phone call in here, see if we can. Let's go to Aaron in Portland. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Hi, go ahead.
Well, I think that all the talk about new surveillance technology is very interesting, but I work for a labor union in Portland, Oregon, and we've already seen much increased abuse of existing surveillance technology, not even to mention the new stuff. For example, workers who are leafleting outside their workplace as part of an organizing drive are regularly photographed and videotaped by Portland's anti-terrorism unit. And what this does is it has, I hope, the unintended consequence of making people who are exercising their democratic right to organize feel like they're doing something wrong or they're doing something illegal. And it's difficult enough for people to stand up for their rights without that sort of increased scrutiny and pressure. So what we're seeing is, you know, I believe a great deal of abuse of surveillance, and any talk of expanding surveillance absolutely has to have oversight to make sure that it's not abused.
Gentlemen, any comments?
I would just, this is Tom, I would just jump in and say that somehow we've polarized this discussion that security is mutually exclusive to privacy, and I think you can have both. The ultimate invasion of privacy, of course, is when you're dead or when someone steals your identity. And so we do need new tools and new technology. One of the tragedies of the last few days and weeks is that we had the technology, and if it had been deployed, it could have made a difference. And if it was deployed along the lines I just suggested, no one's privacy would have been invaded or compromised in any way, and we're losing sight of the big picture.
Let me focus,
and we ought to be using it.
When you say we had the technology and it should have been deployed, or could have, which technology are you talking about?
Face recognition, which is the only thing I know about.
We have seen those faces and photos now at the airports and places like that, and at ATM machines. And you're saying if we had that facial recognition working for those, at least two of those terrorists who've been identified by those pictures, we might have been able to put them into a database.
They were in the database, and so if we were using the technology, we certainly would have a high probability that they would have been stopped at the airport, and even a high probability that they would not even have gotten into the country.
So this is a breakdown in what, then? The failure to use an available technology, you're saying?
No, I think it's a breakdown that would become so intimidated and so polarized in this conversation about privacy versus security that we're not having thoughtful discussions about how to use it in a responsible way along the lines I tried to describe.
Well, speaking of, I guess, one poll, I don't think I disagree with you. I think what I'm saying is security is a sufficient priority that we have to take into account the opportunity such technology affords us to prevent the kinds of things that we've seen done here. I am sensitive, as I'm sure we all are, to the possibilities that these can be abused, just as, you know, still cameras can be used and other available technology. I'm simply saying that this isn't about polarizing the debate. It's trying to bring a measure of reality in light of what we see around us. And this isn't just a threat that somebody's throwing out there. I believe this is a threat informed by the intensive investigation that ensued after the real thing happened to us 3 weeks ago.
My only comment around the polarization is that sometimes people will use the most extreme example that we would all disagree with in terms of its use. I mean, even after September 11th, I mean, I still believe in the Constitution, and I still believe in rights, and I fought for this country to preserve that. And we should not, even in this moment of panic, give up those rights. On the other hand, we shouldn't let outrageous examples and outrageous abuses of the technology prevent us from using it in very responsible ways where it could have made a difference.
Well, then where would you put the limit? I mean, where would you put the limits for using the technology? You know, I cited 1984, and that scenario, if you sat in front of your TV set, there was a camera looking at you all the time. There were helicopters overhead that were keeping track of you, and that doesn't, you know, we do it a little bit differently today where you might be going. What point are you saying we should have a limit? In public only? Do we allow surveillance to go on in the public but not in the privacy of your own home? Where are some of those limits?
Yeah, I mean, I would certainly say in public places where we expect to have law enforcement provide us with security and safety, and these would be events such as sporting events, rock concerts, airports, places of that nature, but certainly not in street levels. When I go into an airport, I expect someone to check my bag. When I'm walking down the street, I don't expect a law enforcement officer to tap me on the shoulder and say, let me look into your briefcase.
What about the internet? Is the internet a public place?
My field of expertise is around the facial recognition and how we can identify criminals and terrorists.
Let me ask my other guest. Where do you see those limits happen?
Well, I think clearly you're seeing, not so much on the Internet necessarily, but through electronic mail and other telecommunication technology, a very aggressive use by bad actors, whether it's organized crime or terrorists or other enemies of the nation, both using these devices in their own right and bringing to bear, in addition, encryption technologies that make it much more difficult for us to monitor what they're doing. A related phenomenon is the one that's been much talked about, the throwaway cell phone, staying a step or two ahead of any wiretap court orders by changing the phone number instead of having that court order applied to the individual. These are areas in which I think technology has simply advanced, and the law must be brought up to date to address.
And I think that's absolutely right. The law must be brought up to date to address it. And to date, we really haven't seen efforts from law enforcement to want to engage in that discussion. And in fact, they are not very clear on the standards that exist today themselves. If you ask different people in the Justice Department whether the subject line of an email message is content under the law, because there's different standards for content and for just the header information, the to and from line, then you hear different answers from people. And that alone is frightening, considering that there is not that kind of push to get these standards set and put into law. So I really do hope that we can engage in this discussion and really set those standards.
All right, let me go to the phones. Number 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Palo Alto. Hi, Barbara. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello, Ira. I'm calling because I think that the whole thesis of this program is really doing a major disservice to the discussion. It really should not be a debate between privacy, giving up privacy, and having security. And the whole thing about facial recognition is in many ways being misrepresented in the opinion.
Well, tell us that.
Well, I don't think terrorists, generally speaking, will tend to pose for good photos. And many of the cases, we found out information about them after the fact. And the whole issue of matching people's faces with digital images is a very problematic technology still. It really doesn't make sense. Say we're going to capture terrorists by doing massive surveillance of people. There are ways in which technology could be useful, and that would be in terms of, for example, checking employees where they do pose for good pictures, and you want to make sure that only people who are authorized getting the access. But to use it as an excuse for massive surveillance of populations is really, really scary.
Well, again, I think different people have different views on this. My own view is this is not mass surveillance. This is surveillance of places that are almost certainly being put under surveillance right now, or should be, where you do have lucrative targets.
I would like to point out that it's actually dealing with security.
I beg your pardon?
You want to deal with security. One of the ways you don't deal with security is to have lots and lots of false positives. Because if you have a lot of false positives, then you're going to find that it's not of much use. This technology is not at a point, and it's not clear if it ever will be at a point where it can be used to capture people who are not going to give you their pictures.
Well,
I think Barbara is perhaps a little bit misinformed on two points. Number one is we do not collect images from people and then willy-nilly put them in the database. The databases are people who are criminals. These are wanted people who are on watch lists and are identified. And the people.
And you mean to tell me that these guys who were involved with these airplane crashes gave you their pictures?
I'm sure that they didn't submit them, but they were on watch lists and they were identified.
But what is the
confident that it wasn't that we surveyed 200 million Americans and put all the faces in the database? I can tell you that for sure. These are people who are wanted in
the terrorists. We're not talking about criminals. And I want to know what the quality is of the pictures that you got of the terrorists. And I would like to suggest that this whole discussion is really distracting from the main issue, which is there are ways to make airplanes travel relatively safe. These tend to cost money. Some of them are not something which the public won't see because they're expensive and they're done, for example, by depressurizing airplane luggage cabins.
But you don't limit this to airplane terrorists, right?
No, but I mean, where are they going to get these pictures from? How do they know who the terrorists are?
Okay.
I mean, this is really really a major distraction, and it could lead to massive surveillance of the American population.
Just the FBI's site, and you'll see the 10 most wanted people, and the people in the FBI database.
What happened to all those pictures of the people at that were screened at the Super Bowl?
Well, what happened at the Super Bowl, the law enforcement gave us a database of several thousand people, and every one of those cases, these were people with criminal records, and we returned all of those images after the Super Bowl. People who entered the stadium, their face was scanned. There was no record to this day. I cannot tell you of the 100,000 people that went in, who they were, where they came from, where they went. I know nothing at all about those people other than they weren't in the database.
That but you can see the fear people have of them, the 100,000 who went there, they're now in some database.
Well, absolutely. In fact, the bigger problem is today with surveillance cameras. Those things on the surveillance camera, the typical person is on a surveillance camera 30 times a day, and those images are stored and retained. And we're the first ones to say that images should be retained. Scan the face for 1 nanosecond, not on the database. It passes, it's dropped, it's not retained in any way.
Are you saying the typical American or anybody is scanned about 30 times a day, you say?
Oh, surely. Surveillance cameras from ATMs, 7-Eleven, to Dunkin' Donuts, gas stations, of course.
In Canada and Britain actually have more. The U.S. is actually probably third in that regard. But again, these are decisions that Tom's company has made. These are not the rules that have gone into effect. You can build these technologies to protect privacy, but most companies out there are not doing that, and they're going into effect without a real discussion about what we should be doing and how
but
the oversight should be.
Isn't that a discussion going on in Capitol Hill now with these new laws that are being talked about?
The laws that are being talked about now are mostly about bringing down the current standards and bringing down the current discussion in terms of how we go about surveillance. For example, earlier, you know, they're taking out the idea of secret searches, giving the authority for greater secret searches, giving the authority for greater searches of educational records with very little oversight, really taking so we're not talking about giving new technical capabilities. We're talking about taking down the oversight and creating more sharing between agencies with less bureaucratic control. That's what this is about.
Let me remind everybody that this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. We did mention briefly, I can't remember who brought it up, the idea of encryption on the Internet. That for years, folks who work on the Internet designing encryption services have been fighting off the attempts by the FBI and other justice officials to allow the creation of a trap door or a key or some way to get into these so that you can then decrypt messages from terrorists or other criminals. Is that going to be, and I know that's now gaining more momentum, but isn't that a two-edged sword where if you can create a system that can be broken into by the government, then you can also create a system that can be broken into by terrorists who might be pretty good at, you know, hackers also?
You can, for sure, and all of this is a two-edged sword. I think we should have stipulated that up front. So this is a question of adjusting in an emergency situation in ways that we wouldn't voluntarily do in a non-emergency situation. And I, for one, wouldn't propose to do in a non-emergency situation. On the encryption issue, however, it seems to me that the state of the art is such that our own intelligence services, we're told, are having an exceedingly difficult time breaking the encryption codes. Some can, I think, be broken, but only with immense computer power applied to it over a protracted period of time.
Well,
in theory, you could have criminal elements doing that too, but I think it unlikely. And in any event, what you want is some capability that allows this to be done in real time to deal with the volume of traffic that is coming across, some of which is clearly involved now with terrorism and some involved perhaps with organized crime and other criminal activity. What the government, I think, reasonably can ask for and should be accommodated on is cooperation from American software companies that make this encryption technology to play with the government the kind of role that AT&T did in the old days before the breakup, which was to support responsible law enforcement and intelligence activities in the national interest.
Well, By the way, if you create an encryption system that can be broken into, doesn't a company that's doing business by the Internet say, I'm more fearful now of doing business because I know they're built into that system is a door that can be broken into, and we know burglars know how to break into some of those doors, whether they be on your house or on the Internet.
Well, there's a difference here, and I'm not a software programmer, God knows, but there's a difference, as I understand it, between breaking the code and having the key. And having the key doesn't necessarily mean that somebody else will be able to break the code simply because you've got the key. It means that when, I would hope, under a court order, much as we do today with wiretaps, the government has an established need to monitor certain traffic. It is given the key. That doesn't mean that anybody else is somehow able to either get the key or to break the code. And that, I think, can provide an appropriate safeguard.
Ira, I think your point is actually right on the money. We had a report. We put out a report with 12 of the leading cryptographers out there who found exactly what you said, that creating a key escrow system, a backdoor system, would create more security risks than it would help. That's available on our website at tvt.org. The terrorists in this instance, in the September 11th attacks, didn't use encrypted email. You know, intelligence services had problems reading the unencrypted email. And if you think that these people that are doing these services, that are using these services now, the regular email, are going to be using an encryption service to hand their key over to the government, you're wrong. They're going to hire someone to create encryption for them where they won't have to hand back the key. It's simply math. It's not creating some kind of system the way that AT&T did in the old days. It's a much different world. It's a decentralized world. And law enforcement can't seem to get beyond that and try and live with the world that we have today.
All right, we're going to take a quick break and come back and talk lots more with Ari Schwartz, Frank Caffey, and Tom Pelotasi, and take your call after a short course. Also, don't go away. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flato, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News.
Support for National Public Radio comes from this and other National Public Radio stations. Contributors also include the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the NEC Foundation of America, 10 years of investing in human potential, the Dibner Fund, encouraging the understanding of science and technology in our lives, and PBS, presenting Life 360, a new series that explores life's surprises, premiering tonight at 9. Local times may vary. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Engineers studying the wreckage of the World Trade Center hope that a close look at the twisted metal beams, scorched concrete, and other debris will help them understand exactly what made the towers fail, and will help them figure out ways to make future buildings safer. On the next Science Friday, what engineers can learn from the recent disaster. That's on Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Welcome back to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. A brief program note. If you like today's program, you're going to love Mondays because Neil Conan on Talk of the Nation is going to continue this discussion about security and learning from the British experience, you know, about the kinds of surveillance that's going on there. You'll also know that there's a lot of experience. So Neil, Conan and his guests on Talk of the Nation are going to talk more about what his experience might learn from across the pond, as they say. We're talking this hour with my guest, Ari Schwartz, Associate Director of the Center for Democracy and Technology in Washington, Frank Gaffney, President of the Center for Security Policy and former Assistant Secretary of Defense under Ronald Reagan, and Tom Colacoffi, President and CEO of Visage Technologies in Littleton, Massachusetts. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Gary in Seattle. Hi, Gary.
Hello, gentlemen. I have a specific question for the experts on facial recognition. Now, my question is, I believe it does need to be in a strict federal safeguard, and I don't want to see it being used on our borders and our own people too much, at least at this point. But I believe we should bear in mind that of the terrorist hijacker cells and the 19 men that struck us so far, I believe almost to a man, they were here on visiting foreign national visas, either student or visitor visas. Now, last I heard, there was about 500,000 people in our country on student visas and maybe a couple million more on visitor visas. And I believe that everyone that wants to visit our country is not a citizen. As the price of entering our country when they come in should be willing to be biometrically scanned. So I believe this is a very lucrative target, and I want to know from the experts, how fast do they think this could be employed nationwide at all of our ports of entry, and how much would it cost us, or alternatively, how much would it cost to equip a single airport with this?
Let me first think I've talked to nuts and bolts, so let's ask Mr. Kolatowski.
We could do an airport for about $500,000, so it's relatively inexpensive, and we could do it in about 30 days. We understand that at least three of these 19 hijackers were on the watch list, and so they were well known, and they could have been and should have been stopped at the border. I would quickly add, I don't think that we should be rounding up people just because they're foreign nationals. One of the great things about facial recognition that we haven't talked about is it eliminates profiling. Today, unfortunately, and we have people who work from us who are from Middle East countries and great citizens, great Americans, or people who are here on visas, and they're being hassled as they go through the airports. And the great thing about our technology is it's only about the map of your face, not about your national origin or your background or any of that sort of thing. And so I think we ought to use it carefully and not in some wholesale way of putting 500,000 students to the database. Gentlemen, any comments?
Well, I just think it's important not to dwell to the exclusion of everything else on this one technology. But I do think that the point needs to be made. Obviously, the quality of this technology, the usefulness of this technology, depends in part on the quality of the database against which the faces are being matched. And there's nothing to say that you're not going to see new terrorists or new criminal elements surfacing for the first time coming in. They won't be picked up because there's no prior record. But I think this could be helpful. And I'm of the view, when it comes to defense, that you do what you can. You bring as much of this capability to bear, even though it's not perfect, even though perhaps it can be under certain circumstances abused, you bring it to bear under arrangements that make sense given the circumstances. And those circumstances today are less dire than they may become. And that's why I'd like to see this kind of capability brought to bear as quickly as possible.
Any comment, Harry Schwartz?
Well, really, I mean, as I said, we need to have that discussion about what about how we involve the standards. Obviously, it's been said several times. Different people have different viewpoints on where on who should be searched and under what circumstances. And we're putting this into place, these technologies into place, without having any discussion about the issue whatsoever, other than this kind of back and forth that we disagree about when it should be used.
But Ira, I guess what I'm saying is this is the time for that discussion. This is not something that we have a lot of time to discuss. I think that is, as you said earlier, what they're trying to do on the Hill. It may not be as comprehensive a discussion as we'd like, but it is a discussion which should be clear that is wartime context.
Let's do this right now. I mean, as I said earlier, what is the subject line of an email message content or not? Is a URL content or not? How do you feel about that?
Personally, I think that if there's a likelihood that those lines will have information that could tip law enforcement or intelligence to evidence of criminal intent, they should be treated accordingly.
But is that
content or whether
you call them
something?
What should the oversight standard be?
Or that the intelligence services in particular, looking for terrorists, are not foreclosed the opportunity to look at them.
I agree with you, but the judge has to review whether there's probable cause or not. That's what I'm asking. And what we're hearing from the Justice Department officials today is that they don't want to have to make that decision at this time, and that's exactly the kind of questions we want to see. Should a judge, third party, make a decision about probable cause or not?
I personally think in a wartime setting as we're in now, the judge cannot be involved in all of the decisions that are going to have to be made.
Everyone agrees with that, but the question is, we've broken this down into content or not content.
I'm breaking it down under a different rubric, and maybe this isn't convenient to you. I'm not a lawyer either, but I'm telling you that I think if under wartime circumstances, when there is evidence coming through that there is planning of a terrorist incident, I want the intelligence services and the law enforcement authorities to be able to make use of that information, to process it, and to put it in the right hands as instantaneously as possible. And well, that means, however you want to define it, that means that a judge is not going to be able to look at all that stuff.
Would and how much share, how much
would this be a permanent arrangement under non-wartime conditions? That are as conducive as we would all like to civil liberties.
And how much sharing of that information should go around the government? Should it be limited to federal? Should it go to state governments? Did somebody find you haven't paid your parking ticket for $150, you know, 2 years ago? Does that raise a flag if you found somebody in the database?
Well, I'll give you the flip side. One of the problems about why the Air Force are not deploying this is because of this lack of sharing. So if one were to go to here to Boston and to the Logan Airport, who would make the decision? Is it Massport? Is it the airlines? Is it the FAA? And then if you work your way through that morass, then it's only one airport out of 450. So, of course, there needs to be some sharing of information.
And if you find somebody, how...
The judgment has to be used here, and I think the judgment ought to be on the side of giving people the latitude, if they're not parking tickets or jaywalking, but if there's evidence that some serious criminal activity is either in the offing or has been associated with an individual, that sharing ought to be done, and ought to be done as friction-free as possible so that the right authorities can move against such an individual.
You know, we're talking about the judges and how the judge is getting the judge involved, and in reality, there have been very, very few cases of wiretap ever being turned down by a judge. In fact, for the terrorist type of wiretap, for an intelligence type wiretap, there has never been a wiretap that has been turned down. Yet the Justice Department wants to lower that standard and get rid of that standard completely.
Well, you presume that that's because the judge isn't doing his job, and I'm presuming that law enforcement is doing a good job.
Oh, no, I completely persuasive that law enforcement is doing a good job. The question is, then why are they trying to lower that standard today?
If I may, I think it's because there is a time lag involved in this process, and that's where rubber meets the road.
We should be focusing on the time lag within the Justice Department rather than focusing on the independent oversight.
Well, I know the only protection that we have. Look, have you ever been to court? As a practical matter, there is a time lag involved in getting the court to consider and act on anything.
For a secret search that an individual could possibly never find out about, even if they're innocent, on an American citizen, yes, I do think that there should be some...
Well, I don't disagree with you. In peacetime and under circumstances in which there's a minimal perceived danger of such individuals doing immense violence to their fellow citizens, or more likely, people who are not their fellow citizens but happen to be American citizens. In those circumstances, I'm just saying, I think we have to look at streamlining this process. That's an emergency.
If you streamline the process, does that mean you take it out of the hands of judges like you do in traffic court? A lot of times there are so many people backed up, some of the clerks take over and start looking through the tickets, you know, and the signing, you pay this fine, you pay that fine. Do we then make a lower, or would you create a division of people who are, instead of the judges, who are going to be making decisions about who should be allowed to be wiretapped, who shouldn't be, especially if we come up with a huge number of people we'd like to wiretap?
Look, I think we're going to have to adapt this to our circumstances. I'm telling you, as somebody who knows much more about sort of the problem we're dealing with than any of these solutions, I think we're going to be facing, in the not-too-distant future, a vastly more problematic situation even than we have today. And I just want to be on record as saying, I think under those circumstances, many of the debates that we're now having are going to be over the side. We're going to see a wholesale streamlining that will be even more offensive to civil libertarians. And I think that we can help mitigate that danger, I hope, by having some streamlining, reasonable judgments made, give latitude to those in the law enforcement business where you need to give them the benefit of the doubt so as to hopefully prevent this kind of catastrophe that may be in the offing.
All right, Ari, before you react, let me remind everybody that this is Talk of Venetian Science, right, from NPR News. Go ahead.
I think I agree that it could be worse in the future, but the question is, do we bring that down? Do we bring down these levels today to a point where we're basically backing up, you know, before our lessons from Watergate, before our lessons from McCarthy?
I would.
Certainly go back to the half in the very near future.
Yeah, I would go back, I think, at least to the circa 1973-74 period, and in order to give law enforcement the kind of domestic surveillance capabilities that it had then and that it clearly needs today.
What did they have? For people who don't remember, for people who don't remember, what kind of abilities did they have then that they don't have?
Well, there was in particular an ability to monitor the activities of groups operating in this country, including American citizens operating in this country, where there was reason to believe that there was illegal or potentially illegal activity underway. And that kind of surveillance has been basically out of bounds since what's been called here the Watergate era. And I think clearly, in a wartime circumstance, and I just can't emphasize that enough, we're not making this up. This is a kind of circumstance we've been in before. We have seen vastly more serious abuses of civil liberties, and it may yet come to that. But we can, I think, mitigate that danger by doing some of this streamlining, some of what Ghazari keeps calling taking down. I think it's bringing up to date the laws that take into account technologies and the kinds of activities that organizations with very malign intent are doing with that technology, potentially to our own collective grave detriment.
I think you're seeing here exactly what we're talking about. He wants to bring things back to the 1970s rather than come up with creative solutions for the future. Ira, I think you gave a perfect example. You know, let's create some kind of independent judiciary to deal with some of these issues. If we're going to invest the resources in it, let's do it right rather than going back to 1970.
Well, I don't think we need to go back to 1970. What stuns me is that we have the tools and technology today that are legal that could have made a difference, and there's no indignation about why it wasn't used. And that's a tragedy, and that's all on all of our heads.
There is indignation. I feel indignant about it, and I'm not wedded to going back to the 70s exactly as we did business in the 70s because that would be crazy. We ought to be using the technology, which is, I think, why we're on this show talking about it, that allows us to do the kinds of surveillance that we previously did and haven't done lately because we persuaded ourselves that it was too much of an infringement on civil liberty and unacceptable in peacetime. And now that's not the circumstance, and now we can use technology, and now I think we have no choice.
All right, so you've got the last word. You've got the last word today, but it's certainly not the last word we're going to hear about that. We'll hear about it or talk about it.
Well, I think you had there a good discussion of some of the issues that were important several years ago, and they've become more and more important even today. We ran about 10 minutes over time, but we wanted to record the entire session, and we hope you'll be joining us again next week.
We'll meet again. Don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. He's smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know.